up ahead of it. So that's the way I handle it, Jim. So let's see if I remember to flip the switch. I mean, sometimes I leave on the radio. Okay, so anybody else?
Question for Jim.
Hey, Steve.
Go ahead.
W2JEK with a question for Jim. I mentioned your surge protector. How much volts does it take to operate that thing?
Don, I really don't know. It's replaceable, and they claim when it dies, it shorts. But they, in the, I have like four of these switches, and in the sheet there, it does not give you that voltage rating of what that thing is. It's a semiconductor, little, you know, tubular type thing. It's held in compression with a screw. You back the screw out, the thing falls out. But interesting, what we ought to do is take it and put the Tony's high pot tester on it and find out what it's rated for.
Yeah, years ago, they used to have neon bulbs as lightning arresters, so to speak. Of course, they take 90 volts to fire them, so you don't want that going into your receiver. I mean, Bell System had a, when I worked there, I had a video about the way everybody had to see it. It was part of your job to see the video about static electricity, and they told you 10 volts can wipe out a transistor, and we were given explicit instructions that some of these boards that we were handling were pretty exotic. We were to use, not to unwrap them until we were on the right where we were going to take them and put them into the equipment, and we were to be using the static strap when we were doing this. Some of these boards ran $50,000 a pop, so they were quite concerned about static. Anyway, back to that. W2JK.
Alrighty. So that was certainly fun. What do you call it? Alrighty. Any following comments to Don?
Gordon?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Don. Go ahead.
Yeah, that static electricity video, I wonder if that's you with Bell System. I was wondering if that thing's still around. Would be an interesting topic for a meeting sometime.
Yeah. I could probably arrange for that, actually, without too much trouble. Some of the field stuff that's used in residential environments and also in some of the commercial environments for lightning protection. Yeah, we could certainly arrange for that. What I could probably arrange for, even to expand the topic to be a little more generally useful for us all, is what you do to handle broadband service interference issues, either to the broadband service or from the broadband service. I kind of do that for a living as part of my job. So that would be fine. We could also arrange to have a little follow-up on the Electromagnetic Compatibility Committee work that we've done. With the AWRL, so we certainly could do that. But in fact, I even have some devices from my employer. What we deploy in various places to take care of suppression issues.
Yeah, I specifically meant. I know there was an issue, and there was one out there that was about static electricity, mostly for the central office equipment. Handling the solid-state devices, the intent was that you could start using your static strap when you're handling this stuff, because just walking across the room can build up enough charge to wipe out an expensive piece of equipment. that's the video that I remember. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever seen that particular one or not.
Well, sure have. In fact, I'm required to, from time to time, even use the stuff if I handling the equipment, a card, or something like that. Yeah. But I do notice that we have another EchoLink station, KJ4PBW. We'll get to you, Shane, in a little bit. We have not forgotten you. And welcome. All right. But there's all sorts of, shall we say, static issues, both in equipment handling and also in station and network integrity preservation, if you will, that we could talk about probably in a very nice comprehensive talk that would be fast-moving and hit on a couple of topics that will be of interest to at least somebody during one portion of it or the other. All righty. Anybody else for Don?
Well, I still have parts B, C, and D.
I know that. Well, I'm coming back to you. Don't worry. I haven't forgotten where this started. I'm treating this like a registry stack. Your register stack. Okay. No problem. All right. So be it. Don, did you want to add any more?
No, thanks. Back on that W2JK.
That's a real good idea. That's a real good idea. Noel, part de.
Part twos, or those, whatever they said. Okay. If I didn't realize it would take that long, otherwise, maybe we should wait till the next week for B, C, and D. What the heck. Okay. At my house, in above the roof, I have three 2-inch pipes mounted. They're the galvanized pipes, and everything is mounted to those. You cannot run hardline or LM400 down through one of those pipes. They're a little bit firm. So what we've been doing is on the beam antenna, on the 6-meter delta loop above it, the beam is mounted on the same rotator. I have a 6-meter vertical. The 6-meter vertical, of course, has a direct connection. They all come down with a piece of relatively flexible coax, such as Berryflex, or, in fact, I think one of them has got a foam center, and a couple of them have, like 9913s. They come down and they end just as you get into the attic. From there into the shack, I run it the rest of the way with LMR 400. Or actually, I got another one that's actually 10 meters, and it's equivalent to LMR 400, but it was actually hardline, and it's pre-made, and, nice little stuff. Okay, well, you got to hook them together up in the attic. I had some nice little coaxial chokes of the type that's made by Radio Work, which is basically a thin piece of coax inside a pipe. They got some ferrite beads on it. They got some connectors. Right now, that's how the two pieces of wire are hooked together. Let me drop it for a second. Okay. What I was going to propose is you're familiar with those in the old days to keep from transmitting out of hand, especially on TV channel 2. You got a bandpass filter that basically passed everything below approximately 33 megahertz or so, 35 megahertz depending. And this way you wouldn't whack whatever it was, channel 2 or 3. You don't even remember. So anyway, they're dirt cheap. You open one of those things up, and it appears to be a nice heavy coil of wire between the coaxial interconductor and the outside. And the the circuit conducts to the next stage by a capacitor, the one that I opened up. It's made of two sheets of copper with the wire soldered onto it, and in between is a sheet of mica. I said, that's one heck of a capacitor. And it occurred to me, see, they're 50 ohms. If I put that up there, it would make a good stop for any static electricity, any little surge current, especially since I have ground wires up there and I could ground the outer of that thing with a couple pair of 6-gauge wires that go to the earth ground outside the station and to the water pipe ground. So, is that something that could be practical? That's an edit, William.
You've made a capacitor, and the surge currents from the discharge are going to go blasting across that. So you're not going to block it with that mica-based capacitor that you've homespun. So what was your... I'm trying to understand what you're really trying to do here. I mean, I know what you're trying to do, but I'm not so sure you understand that you've made a capacitor with that piece of mica, and it's going to... fly that static right across it on a burst basis. Is that really what you wanted?
The capacitor's in series, the inductor is to ground.
But if the capacitor's in series, you'll have some DC blocking, but during that initial spike, aren't you going to get something across it?
I don't think it's designed for anything of a very high intensity. This is K2ZO. I'm taking those apart. Are you going to transmit through this thing? And what frequency, Noel?
I was thinking 2 meters. Not 2 meters. What am I saying? 160 meters up through 10 meters. It's a low pass, so it cuts off approximately, depending on which one you read, 33, 34, 37 megahertz, it cuts off. They can't do anything above 10 meters.
Yeah, as a low-pass filter, it's going to be fine, but are you trying to... I'm kind of tying your two subjects together. Maybe I shouldn't. But are you suggesting that this would also give you relief from the static?
It has a heavy copper wire in the sharp of a coil from the inner conductor to the outside, which will be grounded... Everything would be grounded, yes?
That part will work. You're right. And that is between the hot lead and the ground. I don't know. Do you know what value those inductors are? Because, again, back to Jim's earlier point, the amount of resistance it provides... at the frequency, the impedance it'll provide, the reactance it'll provide at that frequency will be relevant, and you can come up with a time constant based on that the inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance and the capacitor size and figure out just what the voltage will be for an instant of time across that capacitor into your receiver front end. I just hoping the inductive reactance is low enough to at least not create a high hysteresis point and allow a jolt to come into the receiver front end. Anybody else?
KD4QBF disconnected. Connected. KJ4PZW connected. W2TTT.
That was bizarre. I didn't even see the other station come and go. Alrighty. Alright. Anybody else want to comment on this thing?
MS2K.
Mr. MS2K, Jim, go ahead.
Maybe I missed something here. I thought I heard it being said that there was a Series C and a Shunt L. That doesn't sound like a low-pass filter. It's just the opposite.
Multi-stage, you know.
Still not a low-pass filter.
Okay, who made the decision? I'm agreeing with you. Now, think about it. It would just seem to me that you'd end up with, you know, potentially with a, dare I say potentially, with a potential build up behind that capacitor for a short period of time, and then eventually it'll discharge into your receiver front end, and that could be bad.
Yeah, that's true.
Go ahead, Jim.
Coax is grounded properly. Okay. You'd like to think that there would be no static buildup on that. Obviously, you could have an inductive surge. Oops. Fix this. Hang on. You could have a little inductive surge if you had a very, very sharp spike. But considering the coax itself with the shunt L, okay, you're not going to have any DC potential difference between the center and the shield. You put, so, okay, zero is a short. So, you know, the shunt L in the Series C is going to be a high pass regardless. It will allow some high frequencies through. Okay, you might, if you have a sharp edge, the sharp edge is not going to be shorted by the L so much, but it will be passed by the C. So high, you know, high frequency edges can make it through that. Anyway, but either way, you know, there's not a whole lot in that nature that you can do to prevent that problem. That's why you have the a shunt device like a spark gap of, you know, whether it be a vacuum type or some other type to bleed off any high voltage potential from center to shield. Yes, okay.
Noel, before you go to part C or part three, do you have any comments on this part?
No, but the next time I get into kit, let's take a couple of them apart and see what's in there.
Yeah, I think one of the things you need to do is just, you know, go back to the books. In fact, it caught me off guard. I'm glad Jim, you know, reminded us that this is essentially a high-pass filter configuration. And actually, this goes back to also GMK2ZO's presentation of how to balance impedances or match impedances and which circuits will give you what characteristics when you do that high-low impedance and high-low pass or band pass, depending on, you know, where the L and where the C is, as it were, in which configurations. It's probably a very good set of PowerPoints to have. All right, before we go to your next question, so I want to just get KJ4PVW in here. Shane, I see you're from Caroline County, Virginia. Well, in the last 10 years, I or members of my family have spent 10 or more lovely days in Caroline County at Fort AP Hill at the National Boy Scout Jamboree, which will no longer be at Fort AP Hill as of 2013. But I've been twice, and my sons have been there either twice or three times, depending on which son you're talking about. So, over to you, KJ4PVW, in, I thought it said Ruther Glen, Virginia, but you might be in another part of Virginia. I think you said you were in Ladysmith, which I actually do know. anyway, so over to you, Shane.
Good evening to everybody out there this evening. Again, my name is Shane, and I do live in Caroline County, located in Virginia, about 25 miles north of Richmond, Virginia, right off the I-95 corridor. Ladysmith, if you're familiar with the area, if not, if you travel that way off of 95, is exit 110 off of I-95. And Ruther Glen is our mailing address, anything that comes through, because our post office is in Ladysmith is so small it doesn't have any carriers, mail carriers, so everything goes through the Ruther Glen office. But as I said in my little instant messages here, my wife is from New Jersey, so I was going through the Explore View on Echolink. I'm a new user to Echolink as of last night, and this is actually my third contact on Echolink. And so I was going through and finding some places close to her hometown of Mount Holly, New Jersey. And I just happened to click on this one and heard y'all with this net. So I figured I'd sit here and listen a little bit. Sounds like a bunch of good information. So I will turn it back over to Net Control. This is KJ4PVW.
Okay, real quick, though. We actually have two repeaters tied in tonight. One in Brigantine, which is a town immediately north of Atlantic City. Your wife is from a point just north and west of there on the other end of the southern part of New Jersey. And, of course, this repeater is located in Alpine, New Jersey, in the north, in the extreme northeast corner of the state. In fact, a few hundred meters to the east, and you fall 500 feet or 600 feet to the water line and into the Hudson River off the Palisades. So... And most of us are to the west of that repeater, west and south. But anyway, very good. We do this every Thursday night at 9 o'clock, so don't be a stranger, Shane, and do check in. Alrighty. Noel, question number three.
Question number three, and I saw some interesting discussions one way or another on this subject. The same filter. If you were going to use one, or two or three, if you had, considering, say you had a transceiver, you have two or more antennas, perhaps a couple different tuners, perhaps a one that specializes for open wire feed, and perhaps a standard tuner. Where would you put this thing? Where's the proper spot to put this filter if you decided to use one?
All right, so let's repeat this one again. Where do you want to put the... what kind of filter is it?
A low-pass filter that blocks everything above the 10-meter band.
Okay, well, personally... I would put it after the exciter and before the amplifier, and then I might you might actually have a higher power version after the amplifier if the tuned output of the amplifier is not sufficient to adequately suppress harmonics or crud outside the desired passband. That's what I would do, but. You know, better to get it at a low amplitude before you start amplifying it, you know?
So you're thinking if I happen to have a 4-kilowatt one, which I do, made out of copper, boy, that thing's worth its weight in gold. That would be the one after the amplifier and then perhaps one before.
Well, yeah. I mean, if the big fat one has steeper skirts and is more effective, you might want to use it in lieu of the other one. But, without knowing the specifics of the design and their characteristics, it's kind of hard to say, but all things being equal from a performance curve viewpoint, and power being the only variable, then yeah, I would put the weenie one first and the steroidal one after the amplifier.
W2JK. One thing about any of these filters, for them to work at their maximum efficiency, if they're 50 ohm filters, they should be 50 ohms on the input, 50 ohms on the output. In other words, they're looking at a 50 ohm, not that you got a, you're hooked up into, let's say, an impedance or some kind of a mismatched antenna that really needs a tuner. If you have something like that, you really should have a tuner in there to bring that. So it looks like filter is, in other words, go from your transmitter through your filter fence to a tuner, which makes the thing look like 50 ohms on both sides of that filter. So I'm working at its maximum potential. Back to net.
All right. I think that's good advice. Very good advice. If the inputs and outputs are not matched, you will not get the desired performance. Anybody else on this topic? Okay. Let's see. Anybody else on a related topic to, you know, the use of high pass and low pass filters, and particularly low pass filters, since I think we're trying to keep the RFI from TV or the TVs down to a dull roar. I think that's the recurring theme here.
Ready for part D?
Oh, sure, since somebody jumped on that one.
You're bad. Okay. Did you notice that there's quite a few of those for sale at Hamfest, and the price is $8 to $10? And my question is, does anybody use them anymore? Is there a purpose for them? Would you recommend them? And that's the last of the questions. N2OEL.
Yes, I would use them. I would try to... I've actually had some over the years. Right now, the HF side of my shack is kind of in pieces, so nothing's connected, you know, past the antenna switches that I just described before when talking about gym stuff. But, yeah, in general, I would use them. Anybody else? Well, I think you got your answer. Use them or lose them. Anything else, Mr. Noel?
Well, unless you want to hear about the AGM battery.
Do, but I want to get to Jim's question first, so I will take your second set of questions on AGM batteries and hold that for a moment and go to K2ZO, K2BAR.
Okay, well, my question is on the same thing. after our a day in the park, in our operating day, we were discussing batteries. And, of course, you know, we have lead-acid automobile batteries, which are designed for a high surge, like the starting current of a motor, you know, start the car. But the other batteries that we use, or some of us use, are the type of battery that can be discharged and brought up. What do you call that type of battery? That is the there's a name for that.
SLA, sealed lead acid.
But sealed lead acid is one type, but then there's the, you know, the type batteries that are used on motors and stuff like that in boats for the deep cycle. I guess they're deep cycle batteries. Is that the name?
Yeah, basically your trolling motor batteries, your deep cycle, you know, your they're designed to basically for battery backup units, things like that.
Well, the question is, first of all, I did a little research where I found out that you're not supposed to charge a deep cycle battery to the same voltage level that you charge an automobile type battery. In other words, your voltage regulation on your charger should not be set to 13.8. It should be set to say something like 13.4 or 13.5 or so. And although they have the same chemistry, they have different physical characteristics. The question is an AGM battery, which the AGM stands for Advanced Glass Mat, which is the way it's constructed, and that's really the basic difference in those things. Is an AGM battery constructed the same way as a deep cycle? Because I see nothing in there, and I was given three very expensive AGM batteries, and I don't want to hurt them. Back in that.
You know, I don't know. You know where you might be able to find a good resource for that? What's that company that makes those cylindrical batteries? They make they make them in three different configurations and chemistries. They're red, they're yellow, and they're blue. And I think we can get to the root of what you're looking for, Jim, by answering that question and looking at the differences in their products. What the heck's that company called? It's drawing a blank.
Okay, well, as I say, I know that a deep cycle battery is not supposed, even though it's the same chemistry, is not supposed to be charged to 13.8. But I don't know about the AGM batteries that I have, those red ones that I've brought to field day and to our operating day. 40 ampere hours. Noel, you just bought some of those. Maybe you might have some info. It's K2ZO.
Optima batteries. Red top, yellow top, blue top.
It was Optima, thank you. Might want to noodle through that site. In the meantime, answer Jim's question.
The batteries, let me just go back. This is part of the comment before we get to the question part. The batteries that I had in my electric scooter, my wife and I have been for years, maybe 18, 19 years, going for this making strides against breast cancer over in New York. When we were still with Miller and Company, that was 16 years ago, so it was 3 or 4 years before that. And they have the audacity to schedule this walk by 15,000 people on the same day as the bear fox hunt, thus causing me, if I want to keep PXWOW happy, to miss Vera Fox Hunt. In 2008, I got a brand new scooter, brand new sealed lead acid batteries, which, by the way, a pair of 33 amp hour sealed lead acids like I had could easily put out 100 or more amps. In fact, it had a circuit breaker in there at 30 amps, which I popped a few times, mostly when I was in heavy grass or something. Anyways, we did 7 miles. A mile from our parking spot to the Middle Central Park, 5 miles around, a mile back, 7 miles. I noticed one thing with the SLA batteries, sealed lead acid, that when you gave it the throttle, the voltage would dip. There's a voltmeter with the voltage written right on the top there, and the voltage would dip as you took off, because of the internal resistance of the batteries. I had ordered another pair of batteries. However, the supplier called me, or no, actually, they sent it to refund by PayPal and said, oops, sorry, we can't get those. Let me drop it. So, based on the information of the last TechNet, first I went over to West Marine, which, by the way, if you've got a boat, I didn't even know they were there. Right over, you go 17 south, just past the underpass of Route 80. Right there to the right, they're open despite the construction. Fantastic. for voting supplies. They got a heck of a lot of stuff in there. However, at the end of the season, they didn't have much in the way of batteries. So I followed the second suggestion. I had already checked out Batteries Plus, went to Batteries Plus in Whippany, brought my measurements, and they sent me up with a pair of AGM batteries, 44 amp hour, which gives me a third more power. Went on to making strides against breast cancer last Sunday, same 7 miles. Elizabeth walked 6 miles, by the way. One thing I noticed, a couple things. Number one, when you fully charge them, where the other one was reading approximately 25 and a half or volts, because a fully charged battery is 12.8, so it's about right. This thing reads off the scale above 26 volts. The second thing I noticed is they appear to have less internal resistance, a lot less, because the voltage barely goes down when I accelerate rapidly. I didn't even know they were AGMs. I was asking for deep cycle SLAs, and they said, well, these are the best we got. $256, including tax, by the way, for the pair. They really, really have power. I had all sorts of power to spare this time, where with the brand new SLAs, I was running down into the 22-volt range. What I was dragging back. So, third more power. The other thing I found out when I was scrolling through the website is you can make the plates of the AGM deep cycle a lot easier than you can do it with SLAs. You can make a heavier plate, and of course what they do is they're a star electrolyte design. They put the, basically you have the glass mass, have the electrolyte in it, and they left for everything that don't drip off, that drips off. So it's not a gel, it's still a liquid, but it's in there, and I believe the ions do a little bit better moving through the liquid than they do through the gel. What was interesting to me is the voltage is higher, I get more oomph. And on an SLA battery, since you have the glass mats holding everything together, you don't need the physical support structure of an SLA. SLA needs to be held top, bottom, sides, so that the darn plates don't warp or fall out or move or whatever. On the AGMs, you got much more physical constriction because they don't expand, by the way. In the wintertime, SLAs can get cold enough, they'll just expand and blow up. Had that happen to one of them out in the back there. AGMs don't have much of a freezing problem, even when they're discharged. Back to that, Antonio.
Okay, so I was refreshing my memory here, going online, and I found a couple of things. You need at least a two-stage, battery charger. If you're going to use the, excuse me, one second. Okay, if you're going to use an AGM battery, you need at least a two-stage charger, one that will deliver 14.2 to 14.4. in the bulk and acceptance stage, and then for maintenance purposes, you need to rock it back to about 13.2 to 13.4, which is what you were saying, Mr. Jim, and that's absolutely true. That's something definitely to consider if you want to avoid bad things happening. Now, the SLAs, I charge the same way, and maybe I shouldn't, but I do. What I've taken to doing is, and it took me a while to kind of noodle through this, I take the alternator feed from the car, from the truck, through a piece of number 4 into a rig runner. The rig runner gives me 7/10 of a volt drop across its deal, of its configuration. And then, of course, there's the additional cabling going out to the second battery, which is located within the passenger compartment of the vehicle. So, and that's the big SLA, I mean, 155 ampere hour, big SLA. So that's how I, shall we say, handle this problem and prevent overcharging, because I'm tapping off of one of the ports of the rig runner, which has the voltage drop of, the additional voltage drop of the rig runner plus the cabling to that second battery. And I don't have any outline isolators, anything else like that. It seems to be sufficient. And I've never had any problem with that battery getting flattened or the car battery being flattened, and then trying to start the car from the secondary battery. It does not happen. Voltage drop just is too high to even bother that through the rig runner. So, and I haven't popped any fuses on that either. That would be the first thing. So I think we're good. So anyway, comments?
This is K2Zero.
Mr. Shane wants to say something.
Connected K2ACY repeater. No comment for the net. Sorry if I may have mistaken that.
Okay, well, you did say that the Nitro Deep Cycle brand was a good choice, as was the Sears Die Hard Gold Deep Cycle. You actually use that in your F-350. Do you use that as a starting battery or as an equipment battery or both?
I use it for both. It's the S350 gas model, not diesel, so I run it for both, and I've never had a problem out of it at all. And you know, I'm not trying to advertise for them, but I tell you what, 5 years and hadn't had to replace it, and it's been through some brutally cold winters here in Virginia, and every time it's fired right up.
Okay, you're 25 miles north of Richmond. You're talking to people who live in North Jersey. Do you really, really think, do we think you have brutally cold winters compared to what we have here? I mean, I've been to Richmond in the winter. It's cold, but it's not cold like here gets cold. Anyway, I'm busting your horns, Shane, really good. Okay. You might be able to pull it off on your wife since she's from suburban Philly, if you will. But up here, you know, we can go more than a few days sub-zero, you know, in the winter. It's pretty, pretty crazy. But okay, that's very good. So the Sears Die Hard Gold Deep Cycle, as a regular auto battery, interesting thought, okay? And also the Nitro Deep Cycle for your trolling motor. That's very good. All right. That was an interesting comment I saw in the text, and I wanted to bring you out to say it. Good. Anybody else on the repeater want to say something?
Minister K.
Go ahead, Jim.
Just a comment that I had very good luck with some real cheapies, amazingly enough, from Costco. Their own store brand, 27 size, I had on the boat. And I think I used the same set of batteries for over 7 years. And toward the end, I did a load test, which suggested that the batteries are still in pretty darn good shape, even after all those years. Now, I don't think they had ever been allowed to freeze. they were kept in a barn during the winter time and had been touched up at least once or twice during the winter, so they never went down all that much. But still amazing longevity there. MS2K.
Okay, that sounds good. Sounds very good. So the cheapy Costco brand was... How many did you have?
Yeah, I'm only almost down. Yeah, I had two of them on the boat during that time.
You just dropped them in parallel?
Through a full starting current size changeover switch, standard boat changeover switch.
Ah, so one was used to power the boat, and one was used to power all the toys on the boat.
And could be used alternately, they...
Yeah, okay, very good. Now, I'm watching some text here. The reason why Nestor moved to California is because he's from Uruguay, and he decided that the winters here are merciless, so San Diego is like perpetual summer. And, what do you call it? That rides year round. Very good. If you guys want to chat, you can see I'll drop it for you guys on the Echo link. All right. Does anybody else, Peter, want to jump in and say something?
Breaking up pretty hard there, Gordon.
One comment about the Sears deep cycle battery.
A little voltage sensitive. Sorry about that. This is better.
Yes, I had one comment about the Sears deep cycle battery.
Go ahead.
I bought a 115 amp hour Sears deep cycle battery in 1994. Used it in the van. We did not use the diodes. We used a heavy duty relay. And this way I could run my 160 watt two-cure amp underneath. It was underneath the seat. Keep you warm on cold winter days. Anyways, ran that battery until 2008, I guess it was, 2007, 2008. Tested it, and what had happened is the capacity was still there. You could put in, I guess it was, running car headlights, and you could run them for hours. What had happened is, however, the internal resistance went up. So, of course, if you were started drying heavy loads, 20, 30 amps, you started heating up the battery and dropping too much voltage. But if you were doing intermittent use, like a radio that didn't drop out at 11.5 volts, you were fine. Or you could use the device that you got that takes the voltage and puts out a constant 13.8 DC to DC converter. Okay, we were looking for something at the station in Hackensack for the Red Cross. I donated it. I bought a pair of Sears deep cycle batteries that currently I still have. They're rated at, let's see, approximately rated at 25 amp hours each for 200 minutes. That's the exact rating that was on it. Anyways, the battery that I got in 1994, is still in service with a maintainer at the Red Cross in Ridgewood. That was my comment, M2OEL.
Well, that's pretty outstanding. That's very outstanding. Well, if you also have any good battery suggestions.
Don't everybody just go talking at once now.
Alrighty. Alright. K2ZO, did you want to follow up on anything?
K2BAR, K2ZO.
No, I still don't really have the answer to the question. Deep cycle batteries are not supposed to be charged at the same voltage level that a lead acid one in the car. Of course, they're lead acid, but they're a different configuration with the plates. I distinctly remember that with a note that one that I bought a few years ago saying that if you had a charger that was set for 13.8, you know, you could overcharge the thing. Or damage it. So for some reason they don't want to be charged at up to the 13.8 with the cutoff of the current in the charger.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear. All these deep cycle batteries they're recommending that we charge them at, you know, in bulk or acceptance at between 14.2 and 14.4 and slow to 13.2 to 13.4, which is pretty much what you were saying before.
Okay, yeah, well, that's basically it. They don't want to be in a charger that cuts back at, let's say, 13.8. And you can definitely damage one by doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, keep that in mind. And the key point is, you know, get a two-stage charger or a three-stage charger where the trickle state or the maintenance state is 13.2 to 13.4 and not 13.6 or 13.8.
Got one comment for the batteries plus guys.
Yeah, go ahead.
They were very careful to question me about my intended use and what was in here before. I explained to them, and then they asked me if I bought it that way. And I explained to them that I had bought the scooter new, and it came with SLA, sealed lead acid batteries, 33 amp hours. And they said the following, which I don't know if it's true or not, but this is what they told me. They said, if you have a system set up for AGM batteries, and you put in SLAs, you will fry them. Don't do it. The voltage will be too high. However, 99% of the time, if you have a system set up with SLAs and you put in AGMs, they will work satisfactorily. It seems that the AGMs, some part of the charging cycle, the chargers are adjusted to put a higher voltage and the SLAs don't like them. That's what they pretty much told me. And I have a three-stage charger in my scooter built in. And I'm going to have to secure. This is N2OL.
Thank you, Noel, for your font of questions. Very, very good. All right. Anybody else? Okay. So the moral of the story is, do not replace an AGM with an SLA, but you can replace an SLA with an AGM. So, that's good to know. Anybody else? Okay, well, we didn't get a chance to do a full report, but I would like to next week have a report on Portable Day and Jamboree on the Air, since that was the portable operation of the month, as it were, last weekend. And if anyone wants to talk about other portable operations they've done or are planning to do, that'd be fine as well. We we can talk about that next week. I think at this point I'm going to kind of, belay that subject, because that could be a whole nut in itself. But that should be a fun topic for next week. We can also talk more on this battery issue and, of course, chargers as well. Anybody else have anything else they'd like to bring up or comments, questions, confusions? Please call K2BAR W2TTT.
Comment.
And S2K, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been fighting the, there's something screwy on my, remote mic on this Kenwood here. Anyway, drive me a little crazy. One of the little things was there are only, I think there are 41 stations still on the air in the United States, DTV stations, channel 6, between channel 2 and channel 6. Everybody else has moved channel 7 to 51 at this point. So, the problems that we used to have between, say, 6 meters and channel 2, which were adjacent frequencies, that was a horror show. That's pretty rare, and there are no channel 2s in this neighborhood. What's the closest one? Channel 2. South Dakota, Colorado, Nevada, Maine, Nebraska, Wyoming. And that's it. There aren't any of them around here. In any case, on a different subject, battery charger, hang on. Battery charger, I got one from West Marine, seems to be Noel's favorite, anyway, placed on there. They're not too bad if you get them on sale, but they tend to be pretty expensive otherwise. Knows not only about the three basic battery types, for the generally lead-based batteries, but it also keeps track of what temperature the battery is at when you set the charge voltage, charge parameters on it. And that's okay.
Yeah, I got you, Jim. All right. Very good. Yeah. Important things to remember. Anybody else?
J.E.K. with a question for Jim.
Yeah, go ahead, Don.
Question for Jim, NS2K. You said there's no TV happening in this area on those, it used to be channels 2 through 6, but I'm wondering what's going to be in there. Low power transmitters of some kind that are affected if we do have harmonics in that area. It had a megawatt up on top of the Empire State Building when it was the old Channel 2, but now somebody on 5610 10-watt transmitter, and your harmonic might cause their problems. I don't know that any services have been allocated to that those frequencies. I was wondering anybody knew what there were any allocations made it for those frequencies yet. Back to that W2JK.
Well, there are some frequencies. I mean, the actual TV channels themselves, I don't think they've been allocated yet, but I seem to recall that there are people licking their chops at those frequencies. So much so that I had some trouble seeing if we get somebody to at DWRL to proactively ask for a 4 meter allocation at 70 to 70.5 to match the British allocation, and the allocation exists in a lot of other countries, either all of that or part of it. At this point, I'd love to have a 4 meter allocation. I think it'd be a kick. Can you imagine that? 4 meter QSOs across the pond? I think it'd be awesome. Anyway, I'm just kind of curious if anyone has any thoughts on that. Let's see if anybody has any thoughts on that first.
And W2JK, I know there are some frequencies around the 72 megahertz range that are currently used for model airplane remote control.
Yeah, and there's some other services in there too. You have